As I mentioned yesterday, this coming Sunday, Chaf Ches Iyar, is known as Yom Yerushalayim, the anniversary of the liberation of Yerushalayim, which occurred on Chaf Ches Iyar in 1967. And much of what I said with regard to Yom HaTzimut and He'ir is true for Yom Yerushalayim as well, in that it is incumbent upon us to educate ourselves as to what the Nisim were, so that we can then fully appreciate them and give proper Hoda'ah for them. I heard a beautiful word from Rav Mordechai Machlis on a share I was listening to. We're asking Kadosh Baruch Hu to allow us to see His return to Tzion. So we think that means that I should be alive when the Shivas Tzion occurs. He says it's more than that. He says it could be I'll be alive, I'll just be blinded to it. I won't even be aware of it. We're asking Kadosh Baruch Hu to sensitize us to that when it happens, I see it happening, I realize that the process is ongoing, that it's occurring before my very eyes. Sometimes Nisim can occur on the most incredible level and I won't even be in tune to it. And this is certainly true with regard to the 67 war. I'll tell you why. Because we, all of us in this room, were not zocha to be alive at the time that this occurred. This is, once again, as I might have mentioned in the past, to quote Rabbi Norman Lamb, for us it's not history lived, it's history learned. And history learned is much more difficult to experience than history lived. And I say that because if we were alive in 67, we would have been seized by terror, by dread, by fear. Mamish people in Eretz Yisrael believed they were going to be annihilated, like another Holocaust was going to occur within the boundaries and borders of Eretz Yisrael. Mamish. They ordered plasma to be delivered from abroad to Israel before the war. They didn't think they had enough blood on hand to provide for all the need that they would predict would be necessary during the course of the war. They ordered 10,000 graves to be dug in Israel because they were predicting mass casualties. They saw that Egypt had used poison gas on its enemies in Yemen, and they were predicting poison gas was going to be used on Israeli Jews yet again, nearly 20-something years after the Holocaust. People who lived in Chutz La'aretz and were studying in Eretz Yisrael were fleeing in droves, leaving the country. When a deputy editor of Hadavar, one of the Israeli dailies, asked the Prime Minister, Levi Eshkol, in the days preceding the war, what are we waiting for? It was so clear to everybody that Nasser was going to attack and Israel was sitting there doing nothing. And they asked him, why are you so reluctant to do anything? What are you sitting here waiting and doing nothing for? His response was, Blut vetzich gissen vi vaser. Blood's going to flow like water. What should I do? The pressure was so intense that the defense minister, Yitzhak Rabin, suffered a breakdown, a nervous breakdown. He was chain-smoking, drinking coffee, day and night, non-stop. He suffered an emotional breakdown because he mamish felt the acharias of entire klal on his shoulders. How are we going to survive? We're going to be wiped off the face of the map. That's how they were talking. Egypt radio was proclaiming proudly and defiantly, we're going to push the Jews into the sea. PLO officials interviewed publicly in the media before the war said, if there are any Jews left, we'll know how to deal with them. We'll then figure out what to do with them. They're talking in terms of annihilation. It's a pachad. Mamash a pachad. And to make matters worse, Israel was told in no uncertain terms by the U.S., their strongest and only real ally at the time, Lyndon Johnson, reiterated this three times in conversation with Abi Iban, the ambassador of Israel to the UN in days preceding the war. He said to him, Israel will not stand alone unless Israel goes it alone. Which means we will not help you if you attack first. Israel will not stand alone, we'll help you, unless Israel goes it alone, unless you attack first. In other words, he was insisting that Israel sit back and wait to be attacked. If you attack first, we're not going to help you. Because if you attack first, and we help you, Soviet Union jumps in, we don't want a third world war, so if you want us to help you, sit back, let them attack first, and then we'll help you. What's there to help if they get attacked first? You know what the statistics were like? What the odds were? What would happen if the Jews were attacked first? Just read about it. It's staggering. Egypt massing its armies in the south by the Sinai. Jordan, East Jerusalem, was the border with Jordan. They were massing troops. Syria was massing troops in the north by the Golan. The numbers were staggering. The Arab armies had about 700 Air Force fighter jets. Israel had between 200 and 300. More than twice as many Air Force fighter jets, enemy ratio to Israel. In terms of numbers of tanks, look at some of the history books. Martin Gilbert's History of Israel, Michael Oren's History of the Six-Day War. Different figures are provided by those different historians. The smaller figure is that the Arabs, at least on the front with Israel, had 1,600 tanks. And Israel had half that. What that means? Twice as many enemy tanks to Israel's 800, Arabs 1,600. If they wait to be attacked first, there's nothing left to defend. It's over. Jews are mamish terrified of another Holocaust. And it's hard to imagine what that pachem was like. This was what it was like before the war. Defense minister, emotional breakdown, Arabs massing, massive numbers of troops on the front, declaring openly, proudly, they're going to wipe Israel off the map. America tells Israel, don't you dare shoot a gun or we won't help you. This is what we left. This is what was going on. This was the weeks of May and early June, 67. Pachad, mamasha pachad. Hein om levadad yishkon. Klal Yisrael lives there alone. No one helps. There's no one there to help. Except the Kadosh Baruch Hu. They felt so isolated. This was the atmosphere before the Six-Day War broke out. And then when the war began on Monday, June 5th, 1967, with a surprise attack by the Israeli Air Force, they went all out, meaning they risked everything. It was a all or nothing game. By that I mean they sent every jet they had to attack the Egyptian airfields all at the exact same time. The jets, every single jet they had, with the exception of 12, were sent over Egypt. That means if Syria would have sent some jets against Tel Aviv from the north, if Jordan would have sent jets from the east to Yerushalayim, there were 12 planes left guarding the entirety of Israel. Every other plane that they had was over Egypt. The entire Eretz Yisrael was laid out, vulnerable, exposed. The jets took off, timed precisely. They took off at different intervals in groups of four. Each one was assigned an airbase in Egypt to attack, but they left at different intervals so that they each reached their target at the exact same moment. So that the airfields that were in the Sinai, the airfields that were near Cairo, were going to be bombed at the exact same moment. And jets were taking off at random intervals, consistently, throughout the morning, Monday morning. They were timed to be over the Egyptian airfields about 7:45 in the morning. To hit at the exact same time. And they risked everything, mamish everything. The entire cabinet was gathered in the Kiryat Tel Aviv underground base, like waiting and just desperate to find out what's going to happen. Risked everything. Jets flying 15 meters above ground to avoid radar. And the simpleness, we all know that the raid was so astoundingly successful that in the first few hours of that first morning of the war, they destroyed 286 Egyptian planes, mostly on the ground. Astounding success. Astounding success. But if you don't read what you won't know, which compounds the nace beyond belief, is that when the jets took off, they were detected by Jordanian radar. Michael Oren has this in his book, 6 Days of War. Jordanian radar picked up the jets taking off from Israel. Jordanian radar then radioed Amman, their defense minister headquarters, Defense Ministry in Amman immediately cabled a coded signal to Egypt stating war has broken out. Stop for a second and just ask yourself, what would have happened now if they knew that war broke out? If they had a chance to get the planes off the ground, if they had a chance to fight back before they were taken by total surprise, everything would have been changed dramatically, permanently. And why didn't that happen? And this, I tell you, if you don't read, you will not know. And no one knows this because no one reads. People in 6-7 did not know this. Look at it now in the research. You read the book. Michael Oren, you see, he has the research, the records from the Arab governments. The Egyptians did not decipher the coded, cabled message until it was way too late. Why? Because in just days earlier, they had changed their encoding frequencies and neglected to inform their Jordanian allies of that change to their encoding frequencies, and therefore their message remained undeciphered. Blows the mind. And the problem is, if you read the typical literature, what you hear is that the reason for the success of the raid was brilliant strategic planning. And this is true. The Israelis had incredible intelligence information. They knew that 7:45 a.m. was precisely just before the end of the night shift for the radar operators at Egyptian Air Force bases. It was precisely the time when the commanding officers were on their way from home to base, and the pre-cell phone days, they were out of communication while they're driving. So it's the best time to attack. The radar operators are at their most tired, end of their shift. The commanding officers are en route. They're out of communication. Let's get them then. True. Very true. That's not why it worked. It worked because of Nisim bin Eflos, that it just so happened that the Jordanians weren't informed of a change to the Egyptian encoding frequency that happened days earlier, and their warning to the Egyptians was left undeciphered. The Navi Malachim tells us that when Eliyahu Navi confronted the Navi Habal at Har HaKarmel, the Odeh of the Zara, it was a spectator scene for all of Klal Yisrael to see who's going to be the victor here. And he challenged them to a duel, a carbon duel. You put your animal on the Mizbeach, I'll put my animal on the Mizbeach, says Eliyahu Navi. You pray to your Baal, let him send fire down and take the carbon, and I'll pray to God and have him send down fire to burn the carbon. Whoever's God answers, that's the real God. And Eliyahu then turns to God and says, Aneni, Hashem Aneni, answer me, answer me. Pleading for God to respond to his prayer for Eshem and Hashemayim to prove Avodah Zarah wrong, to prove God's existence. So Gemara Brachas Tavav says, why Aneni Hashem Aneni twice? Aneni Sheteret Esh Min Hashemayim, one request that fire should come down from heaven, and a second request, Aneni Shelo Yomru Ma'aseh Shofem Hei. Answer me, I pray, I beg, says Eliyahu, that people shouldn't look at this and say, oh, black magic, oh, witchcraft, doesn't mean anything. What does that mean? That means is that a person is capable of seeing Esh Min Hashemayim, miraculous events, and he can attribute it to, Ma'aseh Shofem Hei. You can look at the Six-Day War and you can tell yourself, oh, strategic planning, brilliant intelligence, great planning, great military skill, fighter pilot, superior training. That's Ma'aseh Shofem Hei. It's Nisim bin Eflos. Unbelievable Nisim. It's not just that. The Egyptians had 100 anti-aircraft batteries stationed by throughout their Air Force bases. They had approximately, according to Michael Oren's account, 27 SAM missile sites, surface-to-air missiles, that were designed by the Soviets to shoot down incoming fighter planes. Not one of these anti-aircraft batteries or surface-to-air missiles fired back at the Israelis. Why not? There was a little bit by Cairo, a little bit anti-aircraft fire there. Otherwise, at every base the Israelis raided in this Monday, June 5th morning on Egypt, there was not one anti-aircraft missile, anti-aircraft battery that fired back. Why not? Incredible. Oren discovered in his research in Egypt, at that same morning, just so happens that Field Marshal Amr, who was the most powerful man in Egyptian military, the commanding, supreme commander of all of Egypt's armies. Field Marshal Amr happened to be flying that morning from one place in Egypt to another. And he was somewhat concerned that his plane might be mistaken on radar for the Israeli enemy planes. So before he flew that morning, he gave strict orders, no anti-aircraft batteries or SAM missile sites should be opening fire this morning. That's what he writes. Can you imagine that? So not only was the Jordanian radar message to the Egypt warning them of war, not deciphered because encoding frequencies were changed just days earlier, but even when the planes were overhead, not one anti-aircraft missile site opened up fire, not one, except by Cairo, not one of the 100 anti-aircraft gun batteries opened up fire, because it just so happened that the field marshal was flying that morning and said, no one shoot. Aneni shalom ma'asek shavim. A person doesn't recognize it as a nisim v'neflos. What's there to say? Unbelievable. Unbelievable. If you don't read about it, you just won't know about it, and you won't appreciate it. You have to read, you have to open your eyes, sechazana einenu, to appreciate the nisim and neflos. And there were numerous such stories on a smaller scale. A Jordanian shell scored a direct hit on Shaar Tzedek Hospital in Yerushalayim and rolled into the maternity ward where 12 mothers and babies were sleeping and didn't explode. But Benny Eisner Zatzal, who was Rebbe in BMT for many years, Merkaz Rav Talmud, was in the army in the Six-Day War, described once how he and his unit approached Kever Rachel in Beit Lechem, and he sees a Jordanian tank coming out of the olive groves at him. What's he supposed to do? The tank is on foot. He says, took out his Uzi. He races toward the tank, screaming, Hashem Uzi Uma Uzi! He says, the soldiers got ran out of tank and just fled. Why? Nisim Benefos. Unbelievable. And what's so astounding is that there was no predetermined plan to take back Yerushalayim. It was not part of the strategy to take back Yerushalayim. In fact, Moshe Dayan was adamantly opposed to attacking Yerushalayim because he was afraid if they enter Temple Mount, Har HaBayis, the Muslims will declare a holy war, religious sites might be damaged, yada, yada, yada. Rav Benny Eisner says it was so not planned to take back Yerushalayim that he says he remembers when he was stationed in the outskirts of Yerushalayim during the days of the war. He hears his general radioing his superior, asking, Ma lasot achshav? And the superior general says back on the radio, on the walkie-talkie, Ma lasot, ta yodea, ain't talking to you, there's no plans here, Zos, just go! What does that mean? So yes, the cabinet eventually decided to take back Yerushalayim. It wasn't part of the plan initially. So yad Hashem. And even that, involves so much nisim and neflos. I was telling Danny before during Seder. Once again, if you read about the history, you'll be familiar with the USS Liberty. Anybody? The USS Liberty? Right. USS Liberty was in the U.S. Navy ship that was stationed in the Mediterranean. It was attacked by Israeli planes and Navy ships during the Six-Day War. About 36 or so American sailors were killed. The Israelis declared afterwards that it was a mistaken identity. They thought it was El Corsair, the Egyptian supply ship. It was really an American ship. They're sorry. Here's a few million dollars to make the reparations to the families of the killed sailors. Okay, that was the official story. If you read the book by Lieutenant Michael Ennis Jr., who was a sailor on that ship, he issues a scathing attack on the Israelis. He says that story is all a bunch of lies. He says our American flag was flying loud and clear above that ship, and Israeli jets flew in low a few times before they attacked. There's no doubt they saw the American flag there. They attacked us knowing we were Americans. And this entire book is one blistering attack on the Israeli cover story. If you read However, which Michael Ennis did not, obviously, the book The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, they write, after conducting interviews with many intelligence officials from that time, that the USS Liberty, which was sailing by itself, awfully close to a war zone, very strange for a U.S. Navy ship to be unaccompanied by any military escorts, but just off the Mediterranean coast, in the middle of a war. He says the USS Liberty was the most electronically advanced spy ship in the world. It was not even under the control of the Pentagon. It was under the control of one of the intelligence agencies. It was packed to the gills with a sensitive electronic equipment. They were picking up every single Israeli military radio transmission from the field. They were using it to chart the movement of Israeli commanders and their units during the war. And they were shipping all that information to the British, who had an intelligence station in Cyprus. The British were then keeping track of all the Israeli army movements during the war and were giving it over to the Egyptians. The point being that as soon as Israelis, who were stretched to the limit in terms of their forces, would withdraw some of their units from the south to concentrate on either Yerushalayim or on the Golan in the north, then the Egyptians would counterattack, make inroads, inflict some damage, and make the war look like an even stalemate. That was the rishus of the Americans and the British in this war. And not all the Americans, but those in the know, that unique little cadre of elite circle of intelligence officials who wanted to curry favor with the Egyptians because they have the oil. Somehow, the Israelis got wind of this, which is why they attacked that ship. Because after warning it to move away from the coast, it did not. They therefore attacked the ship. They didn't sink it deliberately. Rather, they strafed the deck so people would go below deck. Then they napalmed the radar antennas on top of the ship to destroy the intelligence communications apparatus. And the ship sailed off with about 30 or 36 sailors killed. Amavodad Yishkon. Our allies who are on the one hand supplying us, resupplying us during our wars. Same time, at least some of them, or a certain unit amongst them, was undermining the effort. Am levodad yishkon. Klal Yisrael stands all alone. And what happened after the conquest of Yerushalayim was similarly remarkable. Because the achdus that it generated was amazing. As the paratroopers were marching towards Yerushalayim, they were taken in as they approached the old city by residents of Mea Shearim. If you look in the accounts given by soldiers from the paratroop brigade in the book The Lion's Gate by Stephen Pressfield, he has interviews with former paratroopers who describe how these Haredi women, who wouldn't ever talk to these soldiers, let them look at them, invited them to their homes on the way into Yerushalayim, fed them, gave them a place to stay. And that famous picture of the Israeli soldiers unfolding that Israeli flag on some rooftop over the Kotel right after it was taken was because on their way to the old city, when they were stopped off in these homes on their way in, there was one home that they stopped off in, the Cohen family in Beit HaKerem Street, where the grandmother of the family, who had lived in the old city for years and was expelled by the Jordanians, went to one of these paratroopers, his name was Yoram Zamosh, took out a folded Israeli flag and said, "This used to fly over my home in the old city, take it with you." She gives him with tears in her eyes. That was the flag that he unfolded over that rooftop, that the famous picture that you perhaps have seen. She kept it all those years and gave it back to take back with him. But I just concluded one last thought. The achdus that this generated was so incredible. When they were marching back from the old city after the conquest of the old city, in Kikar Shabbos, the Mea Shearim residents were cheering these soldiers. Cheering them. This happened Chaf Ches Iyar. The first day that the Kotel was open to the public was Vav Sivan. First morning of Shavuos. Speak to people who were there. The description is incredible. I heard a description from a Rosh Hashiva who was learning in Yerushalayim that year as a bachur. And he said he described the surreal experience of that Shavuos morning. He said in the pre-dawn hours, there were tens of thousands of Jews streaming to the Kotel from all directions. And they were the biggest mix you can imagine. Kippot Shcharot, Kippot Sugot, Sandalim, Na'alayim, Im Gavayim, B'li Gavayim, mean no difference. And he said they were marching together, singing V'havi Ein Otzir and Ercha as they marched. Overall, that entire day, there were approximately 200,000 Jews, Martin Gilbert writes, who came to Yerushalayim that day alone, in Shavuos, in 13 hours. Those first 13 hours that the Kotel was open to the public. 200,000 Jews came to the Kotel. It was such a sense of unity. He listened to that famous Israeli broadcast from Israel Radio that's played every year on Yom Yerushalayim. And you hear this reporter declaring, Ani lo dati, me'olam lo hayiti, aval, zeo hakotel, v'ani nogea b'avnei hakotel ma'aravi. So he's saying, I never was from, but you might think something's not from, I don't care. No, but the Kotel, I'm touching it. There was such a sense of achdus amongst every segment of Klal Yisrael after the Six-Day War. It brought a whole new meaning to Yerushalayim, Ke'ir Shechubra La'yachta, which the Gemara says means Shesham Na'asim Yisrael Chaverim Zelazeh. The city that unites Klal Yisrael. That's what it is. Shesham Na'asu Chaverim Zelazeh. Klal Yisrael become friends with one another through Yerushalayim. That's why the Malbim comments of Meir Twersky once pointed this out so beautifully in Tehillim Kuflav Beis. Shalu Shlom Yerushalayim. If you want to inquire as to the welfare of Yerushalayim, Yishloyu Ahavoyach. It all depends upon how much shalva, how much tranquility and peace exists between those who love Yerushalayim. When Jews are b'shalom or b'shalva with one another, then Yerushalayim is the Ir Shechubra Li'achdav. And Yerushalayim is doing much better also. Yerushalayim creates Achdus, but Yerushalayim thrives on Achdus. The success of Yerushalayim depends on the Achdus of Klal Yisrael as well. And so you need to read up on these Nisim, because only when you are aware of what happened will you appreciate what happened. That's the only way to really get a sense of what we should be thankful for on Sunday. It's a medium through which you can attain a greater level of Avas Hashem, just for gratefulness and gratitude for what Kadosh Baruch Hu performed for us, the Nisim and the Flos, and to also recognize that this event generates such Achdus and thrives on Achdus, and to be more sensitized to that need as well.